It's very nice to be here with you. And I just took a couple of extra minutes getting ready because I thought I would... I'm supposed to talk about don't believe everything you think, and so I thought I might read a little bit from the book. Yeah. Not because I don't have anything else to say, but because in writing the book, the book came about in an interesting way. I first gave a course, you know, on it at the Abbey, and somebody transcribed it, and then I edited it and made it into a book. And then I thought, gee, you know, we really need some stories in here of practical applications of how you, you know, put these teachings into practice in your life. So we sat around the dining room table after one course and, you know, read through the verses, and people started telling stories from their lives about how, you know, a certain verse applied to their life, how they used it. And so I wrote the stories down and then got more stories from other people over time and put the stories into the book because I think it's really important, you know, so that people, you know, when you read it, so you get an idea of exactly how to practice this, because it's one thing hearing a teaching and, you know, it sounds okay when you hear a teaching, it sounds okay when you read the book, but when you're right in the middle of a mess, yeah, at that time our mind is blank. You know, Dharma, what's Dharma? You know, it's out the window and we're in full gear with ignorance, anger, and attachment. Yeah, and we don't even realize it because we're so habituated to it. Yeah, so I think it's quite helpful to have these stories and then in our meditation to practice by recalling events in our own life where, you know, it would have been helpful to practice these teachings, and then in our meditation, imagine practicing them, transforming our mind, yeah, in our meditation to get some habituation with the technique. And this works very well because lots of times we think, oh, I'm over something, that incident that happened doesn't bother me anymore. And as soon as we remember it in our meditation, it bothers us again. We realize we aren't over it. So for that reason, it's very good to, you know, use things, examples in our own life as practice, to practice these techniques. So before we actually get going with that, I'd like to do a little bit of meditation so we can, you know, go from running around all day or flying around. In my case, I flew here from... where was I yesterday? Brisbane. Yeah. And, yeah, so that we can do something more serious. So sit up straight. Keep your feet flat on the floor. Your hands, the right and the left, thumbs are touching. This is in your lap. And begin by simply feeling yourself sitting here. Feel your feet on the floor and your rear on the cushion. And then just check in with your body, and if there's any tightness or tension anywhere, see if you can just relax that and let it go. Then turn your attention to the breath, breathing normally and naturally. And you can put your attention either at your abdomen and be aware of the rise and fall of your abdomen as you inhale and exhale. or put your attention at the upper lip and the nostrils, and be aware of the cessation of the air as it moves over there. So pick one of the two places and simply observe the breath from that vantage point. If you get distracted by a sound or a thought or a sensation in your body, simply notice it, but bring your attention back to the breath. And so by keeping your attention on one object, in this case the breath, then let the mind settle down. So we'll do this for a few minutes. then let's take a moment and cultivate our motivation. And think that we will listen and share the Dharma this evening so that we can learn how to work with our minds and release afflicted mental states and enhance beneficial and realistic mental states. And let's do this so that in the long term we can make a positive contribution to the welfare of all living beings. So let's place what we're about to do very much in the context of having compassion and care for other living beings and wanting to actively work for their benefit. And then slowly open your eyes and come out of your meditation. So I can't hear myself when I talk like this. Can you hear me in the back? You can. Okay. Then if you can't, then, you know, wave or do something. Okay. Because I can't tell the way it is right now. Okay, so don't believe everything you think. I invented that title simply by, in the course of looking at my own mind, actually, because I realized that, when you hear the Dharma teachings enough and then you check how your own mind is working and compare it to what the Buddha says, you know, and you check kind of how the Buddha describes things and you say, yeah, that makes sense and that's a correct approach to see things, you know. Things are impermanent. You can understand that. They're changing moment by moment. You can understand that, you know, the things around us, worldly objects, are not going to bring us lasting happiness. And, you know, intellectually we can understand that there's no concrete me and so on. But intellectual understanding, it's nice, but it doesn't change our mind, you know. And so when you start comparing, okay, I understand what the Buddha said is this, but my mind thinks the opposite. Yeah? Not in terms of intellectual, but when I just look day to day how I relate to things, you know, I don't think that things are changing moment by moment. I look at things and they seem pretty static, you know? I'm the same person I was yesterday. Do you feel that way? Same person you were yesterday? But, you know, are you really the same person you were yesterday? No. So, you know, there's some dissonance there. The moment we begin to think about it, we realize, no, that's not true. But how do we feel? It is true. Or when we have a problem, yeah, somebody criticizes us. Yeah, they made me angry, didn't they? They hurt my feelings. Isn't that how we feel? Yeah, they hurt my feelings. They made me angry. But when you stop and examine it, did somebody else really hurt your feelings? Somebody else just said some words. There were sound waves coming out of their mouth, and the sound waves hit here. Yeah, that's all that happened physically. Then, you know, the interpretation of the meaning, the hurt feelings, did they come from that person, like, together with the sound waves in here? Where did the hurt feelings come from? In here. Isn't it? Yeah. Did somebody else make us angry? Yeah, did they sneeze and we got the angry virus and, you know, flipped out after that? They made me angry. They didn't make me angry. They just said something. Why did I get angry? Because I have the seed of anger in my mental continuum, and because of the way I described the meaning of the situation to myself. So actually, I made myself angry. They didn't make me angry. You're looking at me like I'm nuts. Yeah? But can you see when you look at your own life? Yeah? Can you see that? Nobody else makes us angry. And yet, what do we say? You made me angry. I'm unhappy because of you. But if you just stop and examine it a little bit, we realize it's not because of the other person. They didn't make us unhappy. They didn't make us angry. Yeah? Our own mind and the way we think did that. So that's why I don't believe everything we think. Because sometimes what we think is totally off the wall. Yeah. I have a little thing that I do with myself when I get mad. I'll say to myself, I have a little discussion, you know. Yeah. So there's the angry me, and then there's the questioner. Questions. Why are you angry? They did this and this and this and this and this and this. Well, yeah, they did that, but why are you angry? Because they said that and that and that and that, and who do they think they are? Well, that might be true, but why are you angry? You know, and I keep doing this, and, you know, I keep on trying my darndest to put it on the other person. They had a bad intention. They wanted to hurt me. Well, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but why did that make you angry? Well, don't you understand? Because they want to hurt my feelings and they want to ruin me. Well, yeah, but why do you get angry at that? Why are you angry? Yeah? And I do that, and then, you know, after some time, it becomes very obvious, like, why am I angry? Yeah? What use does my anger serve? And what good reason do I have for being angry? Well, they wanted to hurt my feelings. But why is that a good reason to be angry? Yeah, we think it's a good reason, don't we? Yeah, somebody, you know, insulted me. Somebody blamed me for something I didn't do. Therefore, I have a right to be angry at them. Yeah, we even use logic. You know, have any of you studied about syllogisms and Buddhist philosophy? Yeah? This is a perfect example of a syllogism. I, as a subject, have a right to get angry, is the predicate. And then the reason is because they wanted to hurt me, or because they insulted me, they accused me of something. Yeah. So we're even using a syllogism. It's very helpful to learn philosophy. Yeah. You start looking at the syllogisms you use in your own mind. So then you have to ask the question, but... Well, first of all, do I know that they deliberately wanted to hurt me? No, I don't know that. So first of all, I'm not quite sure if the reason's even true, that because they wanted to do that. They wanted to denigrate me. First of all, I'm not even sure if it's true. Second of all, if it's true, why is that a good reason to get angry? What makes that a good reason? It's saying... If somebody deliberately wants to hurt me, then I have no other choice in the world but to get mad at them. Is that true? You have no choice? We have no choice. We're pre-programmed. And if we're not mad, then something's wrong with us. Better go to the doctor. Yeah. Make sure you get mad at the appropriate times when you should get mad. Yeah. And we start just pushing it with our mind and saying, you know, well, what good reason do you have? And we realize there is no good reason. Yeah. The only reason we can ever think of is because it's me. Yeah? Yeah? Why do I get mad when somebody accuses me of something I didn't do? Because it's me. Yeah? If that person accuses somebody else of doing something they didn't do, I don't get mad about it. Especially if it's somebody I don't like. Yeah, then go ahead, you know, accuse them some more. So if there was something inherently angry-making about accusing somebody of something they didn't do, then I should get angry every time anyone, anywhere, accuses any person whatsoever of any action whatsoever that they didn't do. Okay. Do I get angry every time somebody is accused unfairly? No. I don't have time and energy for that. It's piddly stuff. Why do these people get so bent out of shape? Somebody said a few words to them. They get so upset. You know, especially when I do it. I say some small thing. They're so ego-sensitive. They think I'm blaming them for something. They explode. These stupid people, so easily offended. They're just so... Yeah, right? But somebody accused me of something I didn't do. This is serious business here. Yeah. And I have every right to get angry, and I am going to get angry, and I'm not just going to get angry, I am going to retaliate. Boom! Yeah? Of course, my fists aren't very good, so I think of lots of other ways to retaliate. Yeah? My weapon of mass destruction is this. Yeah? Yeah? Our mouth can be an incredible weapon of mass destruction. Can it? No, me. I don't say anything mean and nasty and cruel to anybody else. Not me. You know, I'm so sweet. I don't do that. And if I do do it, it's because they deserved it. Yeah. And I'm doing it out of compassion so that they'll know they shouldn't act that way again. You know? I'm protecting them from creating more negative karma. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, when you look sometimes at the way our mind thinks, it's like we're lunatics. I mean, we are, but we think we're normal. But, you know, from a Buddhist definition of mental health, we're absolutely, you know, crazy. We don't see anything as it is. You know, our mind's hallucinating all the time. I was part of the early group of Westerners who wound up at Copan. In Nepal, the monastery on the hill. So most of us started out on Freak Street. That's where you got the chocolate cake and the grass. And we slowly made our way up, you know, to Copan. And I remember us sitting in the tent, you know. This was in Copan's poor days, sitting in this tent, us and the fleas. It was very cozy. And you know, somebody would raise their hand in a stone stupor and say, Lama, what do you think about taking drugs and meditating? Yeah? Doesn't it open your mind to new insights? And Lama would look at us and go, you're already hallucinating, dear. You don't need to take drugs. Yeah? Because the way our mind is, you know, we really don't think clearly. Yeah? We're so sure that the cause of our happiness and suffering is outside of us, for sure. We're so convinced. We live our life like that, day in and day out. So that, if we look, the purpose of our life is always trying to rearrange the external world so that we have what we want and we don't have what we don't want. Yeah, because those certain things out there, they make us happy, so I want them. And certain things out there make me unhappy, so I'm going to push them away and destroy them. And that's our worldview. And it's totally wrong. Totally wrong. Yeah? We just did this thing of, you know, do other people make us mad? No, they don't make us mad. Yeah? Do external things make you happy? You know, there's this new cool thing. I can go to the mall and the shopping center and get this really new cool thing. And it's, you know, it's like reality in a 2x6. Yeah? That's what it is now, isn't it? Yeah? My new object of attachment. Forget all these big things. My reality is this big. You know, I travel a lot. I'm in airports, on planes a lot. People cannot separate from their smartphone. You know, the flight attendant says, turn it off. And these people wait till the very last minute to turn it off. And then when they say you can turn it on, they're already holding it, you know. Turn it on. Yeah, right there, just... Yeah? At the Abbey, when people come, you know, for retreats, you have to turn in your smartphone. People look at us, you know, like, you're asking me to amputate my hand. You know, I can't do that. Yes, you can. But I have an exception. I have a special reason why I need to use my phone during the retreat. Oh, what's your reason? Well, because this one person might call me. Oh, that's very nice. Are they critically ill and they need you? No, but... Yeah? So, you know, we're just completely convinced that, you know, happiness is outside, you know, in this little thing. Yeah? We can't separate. And when you look, why are you so attached to that phone? You know, well, because I'm getting text messages. Phone calls are old-fashioned. Yeah, who wants to call a person? You might actually have to talk to them. Yeah, much better just text them. Then, you know, you don't have to talk to them or anything. Yeah, but, you know, for what? What are we doing? How is that making us happy? Because we're thinking, oh, but, you know, somebody's texting me. That means I'm important. Somebody's texting me. Yeah, it means I exist, doesn't it? Isn't this the greatest ego affirmation? Somebody texts me. Somebody emails me. Yeah? Even if it's just one of those mass emails. Yeah? To sign, you know, kind of sign the petition for whatever it is. Yeah? It's for me. I must exist. I'm important. And we're so attached, we don't want to miss any kind of text message. Do your text messages make you happy? Yeah? How many text messages do you get where you go, I feel so relaxed and happy after reading that. That really made my day. Yeah? Do you get any text messages or emails that make you feel like that? No. But yet, we have to read every single one as soon as it comes in, because this one might be the one that will make us everlastingly happy. We're not sure at all what it would say. Yeah, think about it. You know, this message that we really want, that's going to forever solve our problems. What would it say? What message could you get that's going to make you happy over a long period of time? Yeah. Oh, well, Prince Charming says, I love you forever. That's going to make me happy over a long period of time? Prince Charming is fickle. Yeah, look at the divorce rate. I think Prince Charming is going to love me forever with the divorce rate the way it is and with the number of, you know, past relationships he's had. Forget it. Yeah. It's true, isn't it? Yeah. You think somebody tells you, I love you forever, do you think that's going to solve all your problems? Can that person realistically say, I will love you forever? If that person's a bodhisattva, then yes, you can trust that. But for an ordinary being, if you take refuge in an ordinary sentient being, yeah, ordinary sentient beings whose minds are covered by ignorance, anger, and attachment, do you think they can say something like that and hold to it? Can you say something like that and hold to it? Yes, yes, I can. I just have to meet the right person. Haven't met him yet. Yeah. I'm 95 years old and I'm still looking. Yeah. But you see, you know, our minds just are, we're not seeing things clearly. And so we get so tangled up because we believe everything we think. And a lot of what we think is plain old nonsense. Hmm? Shall I read you some stories? Okay. There's some really good ones in here. I should read you the verse that... here, okay. I like this one, okay? It's about betrayal. No! Yeah? Even if a person for whom you've cared like your own child regards you as an enemy, cherish him specially like a mother does her child who's stricken by sickness. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. So I forgot to mention this book is, it takes the root text by Togme Zambo called The 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas. And so that's one, that's verse 16 of the 37. Okay. Even if a person for whom you've cared like your own child, so somebody you really care about, who you've really put a lot of time and energy into cultivating a relationship with, yeah, and who you really want something good for them, that person regards you as an enemy. Ever happened to you? Huh? I think it's happened to all of us. When it happens, it hurts enormously, doesn't it? And you feel like, or at least I feel like, I'm the only person who has ever been hurt like this, whose trust has ever been betrayed like this. Me! I'm so hurt. Look what they did to me. I was so kind. I was so good. I just wanted everything good for them. And they turned their back on me. You know, and we throw a pity party. Okay, anybody? I throw pity parties, you know. I'm just telling you about my mind, folks, you know. My mother, when I was a little kid, called me Sarah Bernhardt. I didn't know who Sarah Bernhardt was, yeah. But I knew that my emotions were intense and I was going to let the world know whatever I felt, you know. And when somebody hurt me, I felt sorry for myself big time, you know. Anybody else have that problem? Yeah. So we have, actually, the expression pity party comes from one of the inmates I write to. You know, he talked about having a pity party. I said, I know that. I have pity parties. Yeah. I invite everybody to come to my pity party. But they don't show up. So then I pity myself even more. Yeah. They don't want to partake of my lead balloons. Yeah. They don't want to listen to the music of the evening. Poor me. Poor me. Oh, poor me. You know, over and over and over again. Yeah. The ice cream's melted, the cake is stale. You know, there's a real cause for feeling sorry for yourself. You know, nothing goes right. So, here's the situation. Now, yeah, person you cared for turns their back on you, regards you as an enemy. Yeah, you want to have a pity party? Or you want to go give them a taste of their own medicine. Yeah. How can I hurt them? They hurt me so bad. Oh, how can I hurt them back? I'll feel so good when I make them suffer. Yeah, we think like that, don't we? What kind of people are we that we feel good about making somebody else suffer? What does revenge do to our own self-esteem? Yeah? So, that's the state we're in. Our trust has been betrayed. What does Tomei Zambo tell us to do? Cherish him especially like a mother does her child who is stricken by sickness. This guy's too much. Yeah? I mean, this idiot who I helped so much, who I love so much, who turned their back on me and shattered my life and made everything fall apart, and he won't even come to my pity party and acknowledge that he's the source of it. I'm supposed to cherish him specially like a mother does her only child who's sick? No, I can't do that. So that's exactly why this is what we need to do, isn't it? Because an antidote to a mental affliction is always going to be the opposite of what we want to do, of what our deluded mind wants to do. Okay? Cherish this person. How does a mother regard her only child who's sick. How many of you are parents? Yeah? If you have a young child who's sick, how do you look at that child? Yeah? You would do anything for that kid, wouldn't you? Yeah? Your kid has a fever, or they're throwing up, or whatever. They're miserable. As a parent, you would do anything for your kid to be well. So that's how we're supposed to look at this jerk. Yeah? Okay? But if you think about it, it's possible. It's possible. Why is it possible? Because why is that person betraying my trust? Is it because they're happy? Yeah. If that person were happy, would they be treating me the way they are? No. If that person were satisfied and content in their life, would they be betraying the trust of somebody else? No. So that person's somebody who's suffering. If I see somebody who's suffering, what's the appropriate response? Is it for me to throw a pity party? Is it for me to get angry at that person who's suffering? Yeah. The appropriate response is compassion, wishing them to be free of suffering. So can we look at that person who's so miserable that they betrayed our trust and wish them to be free of suffering? Our first reaction is forget it. But, you know, think about it a little bit more. If you could regard that person who hurt you as a parent does their only child, would you feel better than you do now? If you could look at that person with compassion and wish them to be happy and be free of their suffering, would you feel happier than you feel now? Yeah, we would, wouldn't we? So if we change our mind and have compassion for the person who harms us, who is the primary beneficiary of our compassion? The other person or ourselves? Ourselves. Yeah. His Holiness Dalai Lama always says that, you know? He always says, when I cultivate compassion, I'm the principal person who benefits. Maybe the other person benefits from my compassion. I would like them to, but I can't control it and make them benefit. But when I'm compassionate, for sure the person who benefits is me. So that's why he says if you're going to be selfish, be wisely selfish and take care of others. Yeah? Because caring for others is the best way to make ourselves happy and alleviate our own suffering. Okay, let me, which story should I read you? Okay, there's a couple of good ones here. Okay, so this is, a friend told me this story. All these stories are true, by the way. So she said, I helped to start an art project with a Chinese painter and my father, who is a sculptor from Belarus. They wanted to invite international artists to collaborate on a huge sculpture and to construct an art village so that there could be ongoing art projects in China. Yeah. Initially, the project went well,
we started constructing the buildings to display the artwork, as well as a foundry for making the sculptures. My father arranged for several sculptors to go to China, and together they began working on a sculpture that was nearly 10 feet tall. Because the founders of this project were artists, they didn't think so much about the practical aspects of their work. As much as I pleaded with them to put their plan and agreement in writing, they didn't have the type of mentality to do that. Thus, a year into the project, nothing was in writing, the sculpture was half done, and they started to argue because each of them had different ideas. Essentially, the whole project blew up in our faces. Our two families had been very close, and there was a lot of affection and care for each other and a deep connection between us. One family was from Belarus, the other one was from China. We trusted each other, and that was why the project was done by gentlemen's agreement. But just as the verse says, we now regarded each other as enemies. I was extremely hurt on two accounts. First, because we lost the art project and barely managed to get the sculpture out of China. And second, I felt guilty involving my father in a project that turned out so poorly. Meanwhile, I was furious with the Chinese artist. While on the outside I was numb, I would dream of searching for a way to kill him. She said, it was that bad. I looked civil, but in my dreams I was crazy. Have you ever gotten so mad that, you know, you think like that? After a while, I got tired of feeling all of this hate. Also, I met some Buddhists who helped me change my mind. After a while, I was able to forgive him, and now I feel no remnant of hatred, although I still wonder exactly what happened. Now I see it's true that we may trust someone very much, but something can happen that turns us into enemies. But even in this case, we can still have compassion for the other person, like a mother does her child who is stricken by sickness. Okay, here's another one. So this verse speaks of when someone who we have cared for, like our own child, regards us as an enemy. My situation was reversed. My mother regarded me as an enemy. This wasn't always the case. I was my parents' youngest child, and they split up when I was very small. Mom saw me as hers, and I was brought up at her hip. We were quite close for the first 12 years of my life, and I was a spoiled brat. Then I started questioning things and found my heart drawn towards Buddhism. Now, 10 years later, my mom is a fundamentalist Christian, and I am a Buddhist, thinking of becoming a monk. In her eyes, I became an enemy in that I didn't follow her way. And she even said at one point, "You're going to hell," and then added, "It's all my fault." I don't know if you have fundamentalist Christians here like we do in the U.S. Ours are pretty intense. Yeah. No matter what I did, I couldn't do anything that pleased her. It's been hard. She is a person whom I cared so much about, and now the relationship is the opposite. There's even been discussion that maybe we should not talk to each other anymore. The meditation of seeing the mother as kind because she gave me this body and taught me so many life skills has helped me not to fall into anger. In my heart, I want to repay her kindness and hope that one day her mind will change so that I can do that. Okay, want to hear the next verse? This is a fantastic text. If an equal or inferior person, Yeah, okay. So think of an equal person or somebody who's lower than you. Okay. Disparages you out of pride. Somebody who's equal or lower than me disparages me? Just who do they think they are anyway? Yeah. Even people who are better than I am shouldn't disparage me, let alone people who are equal or inferior. Okay, so if an equal or inferior person disparages you out of pride, okay, listen to what you have to do. Place her as you would your spiritual teacher with respect on the crown of your head. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Who is this guy, Tome Zampo, anyway? He doesn't understand, you know. Maybe he can put his enemies on the crown of his head like his spiritual teacher, because he probably doesn't have any big-time enemies. After all, he's a bodhisattva. But me, you know, this 12-year-old brat disparaged me out of pride. You know, I'm supposed to put that 12-year-old brat on the crown of my head like he's my spiritual mentor leading me to enlightenment? No. Tome Sambo says, yes, that's what you have to do. Okay. Why should we put this 12-year-old brat or 22-year-old brat or 32-year-old brat or brat, it doesn't matter, you know, they keep being bratty. Yeah, why should we put this person on the crown of my head like a spiritual mentor? Yeah, my spiritual mentor teaches me the Dharma. Yeah, this jerk doesn't. How can I hold him as my spiritual teacher? Impossible. Right? Totally impossible. Can you think of somebody in your life? Yeah, totally impossible. So I'll tell you my Sam story. Sam is not the real name of this person. But once upon a time, when I was a baby nun, it had only been ordained a couple of years. My teacher sent me to work in an Italian Dharma center. Yeah. And I got along very well with the first director. And then he was replaced and a few other new people came on board. And they all were a bunch of macho Italian men. Okay, any of you had experience? One macho Italian man is bad enough. You get a group of them. So, you know, and I'm an American woman. You know, I'm not an Italian mama who does whatever their son wants and cooks for them and cleans for them and everything. I'm an independent American woman. Yeah. And, you know, we would have, committee meetings because I had an important job in the center. They all made fun of me. Yeah. And one of them in particular, the one who was the director, he and I were like, you know, it was like Los Alamos, you know. We were just like this. And it was all his fault. I mean, this guy, he was too much. You know what this guy did? You want to hear what he did? You know? I mean, I was the SPC. These were in the days before you even had the title spiritual program coordinator, you know? But that's what was my job. He used to come into my office, yeah, and take the work I was doing, you know, work preparing a sadhana or something, he would take it off the desk and take it into his office and not give it back to me. Can you believe? You know? And one night, we were supposed to do the all-night Tara Puja, and, you know, the guys who were members of the center, you know, the construction crew, because this was before the days when you hired construction crews. It was all the volunteers, you know. And he wanted them to work all night. And I said, no, we're going to do Dharma all night. You know, there's an all-night practice to Tara. I said, we're going to do this all night. And he looked at me and he said, I'm going to call Lama Yeshe and tell him you are the worst thing that ever happened to this center. What a threat. You know, calling my teacher to tell him I was the worst thing that happened to the center when, in fact, I was the best thing that ever happened to the center. Yeah. So I wrote Lama Yeshe, I mean, after a while, I wrote Lama a letter. This was in the days before email. So it took a while for the... Dear Lama, you know, I'm sitting here at the place where you sent me to be, and I'm creating so much negative karma, getting angry all the time, even though I'm reading chapter 6 of Shantideva every night like a good girl. And it is all Sam's fault. Lama, can I leave? You know, can I leave? Can I get out of this place? Lama writes back, we'll talk about it, dear. I'll be there in 6 months. So I don't know how, but, you know, I made it through those 6 months. And then Lama came and I got permission to leave. And so I left, and somewhere along the line, I went back to Nepal. I can't remember if I went back directly from there or not. Oh, yes, I did, because I remember Sam didn't give me enough money for the plane ticket when I left. Yeah, and I had no money, so, or very little anyway. Anyway, I made it back to India. And Lama Zopa invited me up for tea. So that's good. So Lama Zopa's my guru. This can be a good discussion. And Rinpoche, yeah, you're laughing. Rinpoche looks at me and says, oh, how was your time in Italy? He said, well, I heard you and Sam had some problems. Yeah. Who was kinder to you, Sam or the Buddha? Rinpoche, what kind of question is that? I didn't say this. I was thinking this. Who's kinder to me, Sam or the Buddha? You know? Of course, the Buddha's kinder. The Buddha teaches me the Dharma. The Buddha leads me on the path. Yeah, the Buddha is the, you know, originator of all these precious teachings that are saving my life. He's much better than Sam. Yeah. And Rinpoche kind of looked at me. You know, he didn't say this, but the look was, you haven't gotten it yet, kid, have you? Yeah, and then he went on to explain to me how Sam was kinder than the Buddha. Yeah. Why was Sam kinder than the Buddha? Because if I wanted to become a fully awakened Buddha, I had to complete the 6 far-reaching practices, the 6 perfections. One of them is fortitude or patience. If you're going to practice fortitude, you have to have somebody who harms you. You cannot practice fortitude without somebody harming you. The Buddha, Rinpoche explained, does not harm me. I can't practice fortitude with the Buddha. I need Sam. Sam is more precious than all the Buddhas of the 10 directions, Rinpoche explained to me. I had, you know, gone into that conversation thinking I might get a little bit of pity from Rinpoche. You know, I really would have liked him to say, oh, I know Sam's a very difficult person. Everybody who works with him has that problem. He's very egotistical and temperamental. And you did such a good job as SPC, you know, working on the program and putting up with him. I'm really proud of you. That's not what Rinpoche said to me. Yeah, he looked at me and he said, Sam is kinder to you than the Buddha. Okay. So you can see this made a strong impression on me. I remember it to this day. Yeah. So it's the very same advice here. Yeah. Place him as you would your spiritual teacher with respect on the crown of your head. Yeah. Because the person who harms us makes us think. Yeah. They make us stop and ask ourselves, you know, this was the one about if an equal or inferior person disparages you out of pride. This person is making us stop and ask ourselves a question that my mother always used to ask me when I was a little girl, which was, just who do you think you are? Okay, so, I mean, my mother asked it in that tone of voice. Dhamma Zampo's asking it in another tone. Who do I think I am? That nobody is supposed to criticize me. Yeah, nobody is supposed to disparage me out of pride. Everybody is supposed to love me. That's one of the rules of the universe, after all. Yeah. So it made me, you know, stop and ask myself, well, you know, just who do I think I am? Because obviously I think I'm somebody that the rest of the universe doesn't think I am. Yeah, I think I'm the most important one in the universe. And nobody else agrees with me. All these stupid people. Yeah. But, you know, so it really made me stop and ask myself, well, am I looking at the situation properly? And, you know, to really see that Sam is teaching me something incredibly important that actually I couldn't learn from the Buddha. Yeah. Sam was teaching me, believe it or not, a little bit of humility. Okay. And so, you know, as life goes on, I don't know about you, but I get knocked around by life. Yeah, it kind of knocks you around after a while. And things come at you when you least expect them. And there you are, thrown into a situation where, you know, you have to, it's sink or swim. You either practice the Dharma or you're really miserable. And, you know, have in subsequent situations where this has happened, you know, being disparaged or trust being broken or whatever, to really see that that is a situation that is like you couldn't think of a better situation for Dharma practice. Yeah? Because Dharma practice means transforming our mind. Yeah? When we're happy and things are going well, we don't think of transforming our mind. We get complacent. Yeah? So it's the people who challenge us that make us look inside and, you know, see what our resources are, discover our resources. let go of wrong conceptions. These people are actually, you know, very kind to us, like our spiritual mentors. Whether we like it or not, it's true. Yeah? It's really true. Okay, let's see. Okay, here's a story. At work, a younger colleague and I were setting up the refreshment table before a meeting. In my culture of origin, older people are automatically respected and treated with courtesy. In the culture of this young person, respect is earned through one's behavior, no matter what your age. While working together, I told this young man to take something out of the refrigerator. Looking back, I see that I did not ask kindly. I gave him an order. He ignored me and asked another person near us whether he should do what I had asked. I felt really angry and told him so, and we exchanged some angry words. Later on, I went to him with the intention to apologize, but the conversation again turned into conflict. At the end of it, I was very upset, but I bowed to him and told him he was right in telling me that I was rude and inconsiderate. You know, so this person was really trying to practice. But for the next 3 weeks, I had to wrestle with my self-centered view of the situation and with the emotions of humiliation, anger, and pride swimming through my head. Okay, you can understand how that person would feel that. I kept rehearsing over and over how I had run several businesses and agencies. I had taught hundreds of students. I had supervised many workers, while he had done none of these things. However, blaming him and praising my own qualities did nothing to alleviate my anger. Yeah, you can be right all you want to be and miserable at the same time. Finally, I consulted my Dharma teacher, who kindly and clearly got me to stop my continuous recitation of his faults and deficiencies and helped me to look at my own process, what I had done and what I needed to address and clean up inside of my own mind. It was tough going. I did a lot of purification around my pride and my anxiety over doing things quickly and efficiently. I carefully examined my compulsion to control everyone and everything when I felt anxious. And my own rudeness when I was in controlling mood. Ring any bells? Gradually, as I calmed down and got more honest with myself, I saw that his feedback was very accurate, that at times I am rude and considerate to others. I was able to relax and do my job more effectively than ever. At the roughest moments of this dispute, he was a good teacher for me, and I am grateful to him for that. Another one? Yeah? Which story should I read? Okay, so this verse is verse 18. It says, though you lack what you need and are constantly disparaged. Okay, so you lack what you need. You need material things, you need companions, or you need help. Yeah, you need something. Yeah, but you're constantly disparaged. So even though you need something, people aren't giving you the time of day and in addition are putting you down. Okay, you're afflicted by dangerous sicknesses, yeah, and injuries and spirits. So, you know, you're really kind of down and out, sounds like, doesn't it? You lack what you need. You're constantly disparaged. You're afflicted by sickness, injury, whatever. Okay? Yeah. Perfect opportunity for a pity party, isn't it? Perfect. What does Togme Sambo advise us? Without discouragement, take on the misdeeds and the pain of all living beings. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. So this is talking about the taking and giving meditation, or the Tonglen meditation, where we imagine taking on the suffering of others, using it to destroy our own self-centeredness and our own ignorance, and then giving them our body possessions and merit so that they can have what they need. That's what this verse is about, doing that meditation. Okay? So it's what the verse is saying, you know, when you're the most down and out, instead of feeling sorry for yourself, you generate compassion for others who are having problems, and you imagine taking on their problems, which are often worse than our own. And not just taking on their problems out of compassion, thinking may they be free of them, but in addition, imagine giving them our body, possessions, and merit, transformed amplified into whatever they need, and sending this out to all living beings. Yeah, that's what we do. The time when we need the most, what we practice is taking on their suffering, giving them our happiness. Yeah. Again, it's the exact opposite of what we feel like doing, which is why it's an antidote to the situation. Okay, so here's someone's story about that. As time marches on and the Dharma deepens, I really can't express in words how much I appreciate the Buddha's teachings. My ability to accept unpleasant situations that I cannot change and to make the most of whatever circumstances I'm in has increased. For example, every autumn I suffer from allergies, and for about a month I feel pretty ill with a stuffy, runny nose, itchy eyes, and all that. I used to dread it. Now I embrace it. Also, last month I went running, and this is a big guy, you know, who wrote this. I went running and my knee buckled, causing some severe damage. I'm glad it happened. It is very good for me to walk around on crutches and to feel the pain of not being mobile. It is also good for me to feel sick. Realistically, these things are small inconveniences compared to the suffering of others. When I first injured my knee, I was, of course, angry and upset because I knew that I would not be able to play hockey for a couple of months. And I hate sitting on the sidelines. Okay. Getting around was going to be difficult, and I couldn't sit on a meditation cushion for about a month, and I had to sit on a chair instead. I'm a lawyer. You got the picture? Yeah, big guy, lawyer, hockey player. I'm a lawyer, and what really hit home was when I showed up in court on crutches. A friend of mine with horrible skin cancer and lesions all over his face and head asked me how I was doing. We all suffer. It's part of life and cyclic existence. Each and every being has to go through it until we attain liberation. Most of the time, our own suffering is really quite trivial. Why make a big deal about it? We all get better eventually until one day we die. If we practice the Dharma well while we're alive, dying will not be terrible, and we'll be able to continue practicing the path to enlightenment in our future lives. Everyone around me is chasing pleasure, worrying about things that we perceive as real, expending energy on negativity, and not even realizing it. My world is chock full of opportunities to practice the Dharma from one moment to the next. I don't know that a human rebirth can get any better. I am healthy, have employment that takes care of shelter, food, and my loved ones, and I have leisure time to practice. Yet much of my life I have spent wishing I was somewhere else more pleasurable. I see others doing the same thing. The attorneys around me work hard, but their minds are longing for the golf course. For me, that's suffering. Yeah. When we take each moment and dedicate ourselves to practice, to cherishing others and realizing their pain, a real sense of purpose and meaning for Dharma practice arises. To me, that's the Dharma. It takes time for the teachings to sink in, but daily meditation, weekly teachings, and a weekly group discussion with fellow practitioners go a long way towards helping. In other words, just living each day and practicing the best we can is the key. Why wish we were somewhere else with different conditions? We have everything we need to practice in front of our face. Just do it. Okay. So I could go on and on. Yeah, I mean, these verses are just, they're really potent, aren't they? Very, very strong. And if we take them to heart, they, you know, really affect our mind. And they become a way, for us to release our own suffering. Because we begin to see how what is causing our suffering is the way we're thinking. That we're thinking in incorrect ways. Yeah? If we change the way we think, we change our experience. So, maybe there's some questions, comments. Yeah, let's open it up and you can ask or express whatever you wish. This is your chance. Don't line up after the teachings, everybody wanting to ask me their own personal question. Yeah? Because chances are, if you have a question, somebody else has the same question. Yeah?
I always find quite a good question. So where do you, when you mentioned that in Italy, the guy took away your stuff and put it in his office, where is the point where you say,
Yeah. Okay. So your question is about, you know, that's all well and fine, but how do you deal with the situation on a practical level? You know, you tame your mind and you try and make it so that you're not angry. But then on a practical level, do you just let your work sit in their office and it doesn't get done? Or do you speak up for yourself? Or what do you do? So I think that's going to depend on the situation. You know, each situation is different. The key is, I think, to get our mind calm. And then when our mind's calm, we can look at the situation and think, okay, what can I do? Often, when something happens, we first go to what should I do without calming our mind. And that gets us really tangled up in knots, because unless we've gotten our mind calm, anything we do is not going to work so well. Okay? So in this kind of situation, I think if I had been more together, yeah, I was not very together. I got mad and, you know, who knows what I did at that time. I'm sure I let him know I was really mad. And I'm sure I spoke badly about him to other people in the center and stirred up some commotion. Because after all, it was all his fault. Right. Oh, I'm glad you agree with me. You're my friend. yeah. So, you know, thinking about it now, if something like that happened, I would try and get my mind calm. And then I would go to the person and I would say, you know, my work was on my desk and it looked like you were carrying some papers when you left. Did you take my work? So I check out the facts first of all, you know. And if they say yes, I took it and da-da-da-da. And then I would probably... There's two ways I might approach it. One way would be to... There's two ways. One is to focus on how I felt and what I needed in that situation. Like, gee, when that happens, I feel violated. Yeah? Because, you know, my work is something that I treasure, and that was my working space. And I need... you know, consideration, and I need communication. Yeah. So one way would have been to just say how I felt and what my needs were without tying them to him. Another way would have been to talk about his feelings and needs. Yeah. Like, did you feel angry? And, you know, did you need, I would, you know, like, I would just, I had no idea why he did it, so I would try and guess maybe what he felt and what he needed as a way of starting a discussion about it. Other questions? Comments?
Mm-hmm. It's what then is right action in relation to that person? This is a situation with my brother who still 3 years later would love to hurt me, and mm-hmm. that's objectively kind of verified by other people.
Mm-hmm.
You can do the work internally.
Yeah.
But where do you, what's the right thing to do with that other person?
Okay, So you do the internal work and try and accept the situation. But again, how do you relate to that person who's harming you? Do you want to be close to your brother?
I want space. That's, to me, I'm in a place where this is the right.
Yeah, but forget about this situation. Would you like to have a good relationship with your brother?
Part of me would. The part that has the compassion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you have to ask yourself, you know, are you holding something against him? Yeah. If you're holding something against him, why are you surprised that he's holding something against you? I will have more to say. I got the feeling like you don't want to hear anymore. Yeah. Because I think we have to ask ourselves, you know,
if I'm holding something against somebody, then it's not, you know, all coming from the other person. And do I want to go through my life holding a grudge against somebody? Yeah. You may not, it doesn't mean that you have to be super close with your brother, but just the question, do I want to go through my life holding a grudge against him? You know, what would holding a grudge against my brother do in my life? How would it affect me? Would it benefit me? No, I'm going to feel crummy. Yeah, I'm going to feel real crummy. And there will probably be situations when our parents are old and sick when we have to work together. And if I hold something against him, it's going to be real difficult to work together for our parents' benefit. Okay, so maybe I need to do some work on myself to try and release whatever it is I'm holding. Because if I don't, it's really going to get worse. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would say that's the first step. Then take it from there. Could you speak louder?
In this book, at the beginning of the book, you were talking about how people were viewing the smartphone.
Yeah.
I just remember my son, he's so addicted to everything.
He what?
My son, he's really addicted to everything that is electronic. And when he's away from it, he feels really unhappy.
Yeah. You know, I heard that they're starting to do addiction treatment. No, seriously. You know, addiction treatment, especially for young people who are addicted to electronics and gadgets and things like that. Yeah? Because I do think it brings on a certain kind of addictiveness in the mind. So you might... you might go online and see if there's other parents. Oops. Yeah. But I bet you there's a blog for parents whose kids are addicted to blogs. Yeah. Yeah, it's a difficult thing, but, you know. Okay, and yeah.
At the beginning, you illustrated how you were arguing so with your online, basically.
Uh-huh.
And my question is, given that you also said basically everything online comes up with this nonsense, or a lot of it is nonsense, to what extent is it actually beneficial to enter these arguments with your online rather than maybe meditation where you just try to feel your body and sort of try to ignore, blend out what your mind is actually coming up with?
Okay.
I think given the topic or the way you framed today's talk, is it really, where is it beneficial to argue with your own mind?
Okay.
Versus just getting lost in the argument and then waking up 2 days later and thinking, oh my God, I just spent 2 days arguing with myself. Yeah. Just made the problem worse rather than actually coming to the conclusion that you arrived at saying, well, there's actually no reason for me to be angry about it.
Mm.
You just go into this never-ending circle of arguing inside yourself.
Okay. There's a difference between applying a Dharma antidote and arguing with yourself. Those are two different things. Okay. Arguing with yourself, it's a civil war. And both sides are affected by delusion.
Yeah, so that's not what you want to do, is argue with yourself. Yeah, applying an antidote to a deluded or afflicted state of mind is a different ball game, because there you're able to say, wow, you know, what I'm thinking is wrong. Or you, maybe you can't even see how what you're thinking is wrong yet, and it's just, I'm unhappy and I'm angry. And if I'm unhappy and angry, then for sure a mental affliction is present. So I've got to figure out which mental affliction it is, and then figure out what the antidote to it is, and meditate on that antidote. So, you know, then your question was, why not just sit and watch your breath and push that all out of your mouth? Okay. So for some people that may work. However, yeah, I find that unless I am fully convinced that the way my mind is perceiving the situation is incorrect, I cannot give up the affliction. I might stuff it down and watch my breath and visualize this and this, but as long as one part of me is hooked into the story and convinced that my story is right, I really can't give it up. Yeah. So for me, applying the antidote is really essential. I have to be able to prove to myself again and again and again, yeah, that the way I'm looking at this situation is incorrect. Yeah. Because my mind is very stubborn. I can't just say, oh, I'm angry, forget the anger. No, I'm angry and I'm right. Yeah. And I should let this person know that for his own good. Yeah. So until I really, you know, can see that the way I'm thinking is not right, I can't give up my anger. So I have to really stick with the antidotes. Okay, let's have a little bit of silent meditation. So just, this is a short meditation. Think about something that you heard tonight. Yeah? One of the stories, maybe one of the verses. Think about it in such a way that you remember it and apply it to your own life. Okay? So that you'll really have something to take with you after the teaching.
And then let's dedicate the merit. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.